Welcome to the Philippe Matthews Show at thepmshow.tv. Named the Oprah of the Internet by Mark Victor Hansen, Philippe Matthews doesn't ask questions that are different. He simply asks questions that make a difference. The Philippe Matthews Show features entertainers, bestsellers, authors, thought leaders, change agents, and world-class experts in the field of personal, spiritual, and professional development. An internet marketing entrepreneur, Philippe is the creator of the How Movement, dedicated to teaching people how to move from the mindset of hope to the process of how. If you are ready to take your life to the next level, move from the mindset of why to the mindset of why not. Tune in right now to this latest edition of the Philippe Matthews Show and watch your life grow.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, on the Philippe Matthews Show, and we've got an incredible guest on the show with me today. She is multi-talented, multifaceted. She is an author. She is a filmmaker. She is a philanthropist and a real mover and shaker in the world, and someone that the world definitely needs. She is promoting her latest work called Finding Hope with Molly Quinn, and she's just doing some great things in the world. I would like to welcome Diane Nam. How are you, my dear?
I'm great, Philippe. Thank you so much for having me today. It is such a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, it's awesome, man. I looked at all of your stuff and the film, and it was absolutely amazing. And what's interesting to me is, you know, recently, kind of within the last couple of years, there has been, talk about human trafficking, which was kind of like hush-hush for so long in the media. And now it's becoming more mainstream. There's a lot of celebrities that are getting behind it. And then here you come along with something that I had never even thought about. And also would associate with, you know, old times as opposed to current times. And that is the, there's a particular term that is used for this. What is it called that's dealing with Molly Quinn's story?
Well, Finding Hope is actually kind of a combination or a sequel, if you will, to the first film that I did, which she was also in, called The Sacrifice. And so the main premise that began this whole series of events was that I had discovered that in modern day times, actually, not even in history, there are polygamous cults living within the United States who basically, cloak what they're doing in religious freedom. And what they're doing essentially is using children for slave labor, for sex, and calling it marriage. And basically breeding the children within their communities to use them in this fashion. They're not limited to the United States. They're obviously everywhere around the world, but they also exist in the United States, in Canada, and in Mexico. They're not a huge section of the population, but there's enough of them for us to be concerned that there are girls living in this manner, and young boys, too, as a matter of fact, who are particularly ill-treated by the same cults. So the first movie I made called The Sacrifice, which, if you don't mind my saying, is available on iTunes. And it's one of the first films that Molly appears in. She's also co-starring with Chris Mulkey, Richard Reel, John Lindstrom, and Darby Stanchfield, who's on Scandal. They give wonderful performances, and it's about the day that a polygamous cult leader comes to take a 13-year-old girl from her family, and that family resists him. And when that... And when that story, which was also kind of right before the whole West Texas compound was busted with all those kids and stuff like that, when that story broke, a lot of people were then concerned, well, what happened to this little girl? And so In the intervening years, Molly and I had talked about wanting to do another film that was, kind of a sequel to The Sacrifice. To tell people what had happened. And during that time, I'd also done a lot of writing mentor workshops at-risk facilities, like group homes and rehab centers, and heard a lot of stories of teen runaway girls, a lot of things that have happened to them. And a lot of stories that were never going to get told, and that I didn't want to tell in the context of those individual girls because it would either put them at risk or it would somehow compromise their their attempts to get out of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I took that little girl from the sacrifice, and I pondered what would happen to her if 3 years later something happens that makes her life at home so untenable that she has to run away. And then what does a girl like that who's never been out in the world face when she gets to a big city and has no choices, you know, not safe at home and nowhere to go?
What wow.
To that girl.
That is amazing.
And that's finding hope.
You know, it's extremely powerful because when I watch this piece, you think, oh, my God, this is happening right now as I'm watching this. This is happening in real time. This is not, quote-unquote, cliche, a movie.
Right. You know,
and
it's
very
even
hard. It's very difficult. What do you do as just a human being who now is aware of this? What do you do?
You know, there are a lot of organizations for a lot of different of the you know, of the events that you may be part of. I mean, if you see teen girls who obviously are alone or obviously on the run or obviously unprotected in some way, you know, instead of assuming that they're on the street of their own volition or that they're on the street because they actually want, you know, to be selling sex, there are tons of hotlines to call where you think that there may be trafficking victims. The FBI has one. Local police enforcements all have one. The states are now enacting all kinds of different hotlines. I don't have the numbers available to me, but I mean, each day, every state becomes more and more active or proactive in the effort to rescue trafficking, trafficking workers, and to give them an opportunity to call. If you are familiar with girls who are in a hard place at home and you see what's happening, or if it's your friends and you see what's happening, you know, there are also hotline places to call in terms of, you know, domestic abuse. And then for the kids themselves, there are places like Covenant House, like Children of the Night in Hollywood. I mean, each and every city has its own organization. Part of what I was hoping to do with Finding Hope, the film, once the film has seen its, you know, its time on the festivals and been distributed, is to move it into a television series, where at the end of each episode, we would provide a hotline number for whatever was specific to that evening's episode and the activities that were involved during that, you know, the event.
Wow.
In an episode. As another way of just making this, like, easily accessible on phones, on, you know, screens, on anything, where people should call, so that it just becomes as easy to remember as 911 because you've seen it weekly. So that's the hope. I mean, the fact that human trafficking has become such a hot button issue for so many people is in fact just wonderful. I mean, in the fact that it's not a dirty secret anymore, and nobody's blaming the people involved.
Exactly. You know, we hear all the time on certain sets when movies are made of about very heavy topics and real life subjects, how, you know, it's very difficult sometimes for the actors and the director to get into a particular role, and for directors to be able to explain the role that they need to get into. In Finding Hope, with the gentleman who was playing the role of the monster in the movie, were there any times when people were, you know, going through the script and getting the sides and kind of rehearsing together? Was there any time on the set when it was very difficult for them to repeat certain scenes and read certain aspects of the script?
Well, let me mention my entire cast of Finding Hope, because I was, in fact, the luckiest director in the universe. to not only have Molly Quinn, Richard Reel, Chris Mulkey, James Morrison, Kristen Dalton, Rhea Brusseau, Andy McKenzie, forgetting somebody, Christine Elise, Karen Landry. I mean, I had a cast that only, you know, that some people only dream about and that you only get once in a lifetime. And as for your question about each of the difficulties, whether they be villain or whether they be Molly's role or even the young man who was in the cellar, each of them, you know, sort of brought with them their own methodology. We did not have a lot of time for rehearsal. It was a low-budget film, and so, you know, they kind of each came, they brought it with them, so to speak. I mean, we did as many takes as we needed to in order to be able to get what we got, but certainly what they brought with them, you know, had cut down dramatically on rehearsal time. The thing to keep in mind, though, which I think every single actor I've worked with and, you know, is the earmark of a professional, is that they find the humanity, they find something to like or to be proud of or to feel comfortable with, with their character. And that's what makes, in Chris's case, the evil that much more frightening. Because he and I talked about that, and the truth is that the Rev character sees nothing wrong with what he's doing. He feels he's acting out of love, which goes to his own backstory and to the depth of his own character and his own upbringing. But he believes he is the patriarch of a loving family.
Wow.
And in believing that, he acts accordingly. And
amazing.
That's what each and every actor brought to it, is that they believed with all their hearts that their characters had the, you know, had whatever good they needed to in order to be able to do what they were doing.
Unbelievable. How long did it take you to shoot this from start to finish?
We shot in 8 days. They were, even though you wouldn't know it, the rainiest 8 days. It might be 7 days, but we had to take 1 day break. We had the rainiest the week that you could possibly have imagined. And I mean, I also have to mention that my producer Eric Mofford and my director of photography Mark Peterson were awesome. I mean, this train moved along at the pace it was supposed to each and every day, because we had, you know, only a specific amount of money and a specific amount of time and availability for all of the actors, and they just moved it along, and we made sure we got absolutely every shot we said we were going to get. And it was kind of like, you know, lightning in a bottle sometimes happens. That's what those days were like, because despite the fact that it was a downpour like no other, somehow my crew managed to figure out how to pretend it wasn't raining. I mean, that was a miracle.
That was amazing. Now, how long did it take for this to get to those 8 days? I mean, there's obviously a lot of great planning and making phenomenal work of this level. Talk to us about the process from inception to first day of set.
Well, the script took a little bit of time because, as I said, in finishing The Sacrifice and wanting to do something with Molly, I knew I wanted to do something about what would happen to her later. But I guess it took a fair amount of my real world exposure to stories that had actually happened for the story to ultimately take shape. So I would say that although I did not work on the script, you know, nonstop, it took about 2 years before the script was where I wanted it to go from where we had been. And then, you know, I know a lot of people feel this way, and I think it's just the best thing to do, which is that you prepare as much as you possibly can ahead of time. I mean, obviously the things you can't control, but you prepare as much ahead of time. So I would say that our prep time was maybe 4 months.
Okay.
That we knew exactly what we were going to shoot. We knew exactly where the scenes were going to be. We scouted to make sure that these were the least expensive but the best possible production value in each of the locations. And so once those 3 to 4 months were ready to roll, we also had to make sure that it fit with all of the actors' schedules because they were all very busy people, especially Molly's schedule, you know, for Castle. And so serendipitously, December was the time when we shot.
Wow.
So we shot for I think we went from December 10th to December 18th or December 20th with like a day or two in between when we had to stop so that everybody could rest. Because
How long was post?
Hard days. Sorry?
I said, how long was post-production? After you got it, everything was in a can, that was it? It was the wrap?
Because I wanted everything to be beautiful, and because money is slow and hard to come by, we waited for the sound design place that we could afford that we knew would be doing the best possible place.
Okay.
And then, which was Hacienda Post, and then we waited for the best possible color correction place, and for them, they're also a busy place. Keep Me Posted, they're very busy, so we wanted to make sure we got in to see them, you know, and had them do it. And then I had to just make sure we had the money to pay. And so it was a slow process getting it to the beautiful, beautiful film that it looks like now. And only with the assistance and the skill and care of everybody involved. And my editor, Lindsay Mofford, who is just one of the most all-time best editors in the universe. She just is. I wanted her to have enough time so that before we locked picture, we were happy with absolutely every single moment and every single shot.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't trying to rush this because I just really wanted this to be the best it could be because I didn't know if I'd ever have enough money to make anything again.
Right. That makes sense.
This had to be it.
Well said. So okay, obviously you did. You got the money to get it done. And you've got the Newport Beach Film Festival coming up where it's going to be screened. But after that, what and where can people find this film and be able to see it, watch it, share it, take notes, and take action?
Well, I think that since we're just at the very beginning of doing festivals for this, we're waiting to hear from a number of different places as to where it may be screened in the next, you know, I'd say in the next 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the next 8 months, although a couple of distributors, including the one who first picked up The Sacrifice, is interested in distributing it, I'm just waiting to see what my options will be. And then I will have a better idea. Because it may be available on iTunes, we may decide to go with a different streaming entity. It just depends on what I think will be the, you know, the most effective way of getting the film out there.
Okay.
But we have had a lot of interest in it, and I just have to sort of determine what I think will be best for it. But what I think what's best for it now is that it go to the festivals, because I think once people see the film, they get a different take on the reason why kids end up as runaways, and they get a different take on what happens to a runaway and what their options are. And I think that there's a value in that.
Absolutely. Now, you come from a philanthropic background. You're the executive artistic director of West Broadway, which is a 501c3. Talk to us about that and what you do there and how you empower children.
Well, you know, whenever anybody asks me, you know, what are the things that I love most in terms of entertainment, my answer is always, you know, books, theater, and film. And because I was, I was doing mentoring at-risk facilities, I was doing these writing workshops, and I would, when talking to the guys I was mentoring, you know, give them kind of like writing shortcut tips to say, oh, it's like this story or it's like that story, and usually referencing sort of children's classic literature stuff. And the boys looked at me as if I had three heads, and they didn't know what the heck I was talking about. And they were just sort of like certain that I was speaking a language that they just hadn't heard. And in fact, that was true. So we sort of, it, however stupid it was that I didn't know this before, it became clear that there was a large segment of the population of our youth who have not been read to in terms of children's stories.
Wow.
Stories that I loved as a kid, and that made up my entire imagination, and that I filled my children's heads with when they were young as well. And because to me, reading was, you know, reading was everything. I mean, I had a lovely home in Brooklyn with my parents, but somehow reading was the thing that I dissolved into, and that was my entire life. And when I realized that that was not the case for so many people, and I do, you know, I have written a bunch of children's books, and a lot of them are classic adaptations. And so what I decided was that perhaps a good thing to do would be to develop a nonprofit theater company which adapted children's classics for a modern audience, made them interactive, and then would bring the children's attention to the fact that these books existed at all, because I guess so many of them were sort of like dusty on shelves and not used much. And it would then sort of motivate them to go back and read those original classics if my adaptation was funny enough and if my adaptation was interactive enough. So I founded West of Broadway, and that's what I started to do, you know, on a very shoestring budget, because low-budget theater is a lot more low-budget than low-budget film.
right.
I was able to, I adapted a bunch of different stories that mattered to me. So, for instance, I turned Peter Rabbit into a Star Wars spoof. So it was Bunny Wars episode 4.
nice.
And then I turned The Christmas Carol into Mrs. Scrooge, and then ultimately made Mrs. Scrooge a musical. And so for several years, we put on these productions that I sometimes charged the public for. But then I would hook up with, like, the Children's Development Center in Santa Monica or any of the at-risk facilities in which I had writing mentored, and I would just do the shows for those audiences so that they could expose the kids to the story. I did Huck, and I set it in the time after the flood of Katrina, so that, you know, it had some kind of a modern sensibility for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would always put the biography of the author of the original story. So I found that when it was in the program and an excerpt of the old story, that the kids would then go back and read stories by Mark Twain or read by Beatrix Potter or by Charles Dickens. And
okay.
I almost always put the author into the play, and then the kids always feel like they've met the author.
Mm-hmm.
So feel a special, you know, a special kinship when they are going into a store or a library and saying, "Well, I met Mark Twain. I'd like to read his book."
Oh, wow, nice.
So, you know, knowing that that's how that worked, West of Broadway gave me a lot of joy in terms of
sure. Now, you have written over 65 children's books.
That is correct.
When do you sleep? Do you believe in sleep? Do you have a sleep disorder? I mean, you're making films, you're doing a running a 501c3, you write 65 children's books. My goodness gracious. You obviously love children. That's blatantly obvious.
Yes,
so talk to us about writing 65 children's books. over the span of, you know, I guess 10, 20 years or whatever.
Yeah, it's been 10 or 20 years, yes.
But still, 65 books. Anyway, what inspires you to write so many stories? Because, I mean, you know, the writing process, everyone, you know, there's obviously a large group of people that are like, hey, I am creative, but there's no way in heck I could write 65 children's books, you know, run a nonprofit dedicated to books, and then make film and screenwriting and all that. I mean, you talk about right braided. I mean, is your forehead like oddly shaped? I mean, you look great on from the photos that I've seen of you, but I mean, is there any like deformity that we need to know about so we can get this level of creativity out here and duplicate it somehow? My goodness.
Well, you're a modest man because you're pretty creative yourself. So I read about you too.
Uh-oh, I know you did. You're a filmmaker. Yeah, you're a researcher. Uh-oh.
That's right. So, I mean, if we're going to talk about amazing human beings, you know, we'd have to go back to you.
Oh, this is good. She's trying to reverse it, but I'm not going to let you. I am not going to let you because I'm on the 65 children's books. I mean, I think this is fantastic. I just, you know, there's just so many things that can go wrong, even in a great household. And without stories and books and literacy, it's just that child grows up just with, I think, a lifelong deficit. That's
right.
What my
missing.
Personal belief is.
Exactly. Missing something. And I'm personally opposed to that.
Yeah, I would
argue. It's really hard to fix that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I started out when I first graduated from college in publishing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is when I was living in New York. And so children's book publishing became, in fact, my very first profession. So I worked on the other side of the desk as an editor for a long time, about 7 years, before I moved to L.A. When I moved to L.A., I found that it was really hard to do the publishing editorial part of it from Los Angeles. And so that's when I really started in earnest to concentrate on the freelance writing element. And so, you know, I did a couple of YA novels then, and then I also continued to do anything from preschool up. So a number of the publishers with whom I had worked, a number of the editors with whom I had worked when I was in publishing, you know, we stayed in touch, and if there were books that needed to be written, then they would contact me. And so I ended up, for some reason, I guess serendipitously, adapting a lot of children's classics, specifically for Sterling Books, which was also a division of Barnes & Noble.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I do even today. I have, I think, there's a series of fairy tale books called the Silver Penny Books, five or six of which have already been published and 4 more which are coming out, I think, later this year. And then Roman Myths, which is a collection or a compilation of Roman mythology, which is a sequel to my Greek myths book, is coming out later this year as well. So, I mean, you're right when you say I love children and I love everything about either advocacy for or entertainment of. I think that's kind of been co-joined in my DNA since forever. And I think that the responsibility is both. You know, I feel like the entertainment needs to be something that's nourishing, and I feel like the advocacy needs to be something that's protective.
Well, I think it's beautiful because in the world of Hollywood, even though you don't necessarily, are not necessarily of Hollywood, you know, this voice, your voice and vision, needs to be heard and seen. And I think it would be a breath of fresh air in the industry. Now, how do you handle that, though, being in still, unfortunately, a male-dominated industry?
Well, I guess I don't. I mean, you know, I'm more interested in what it is I can accomplish myself within the means available to me, howsoever. I'm not looking to be mainstream in the sense that I recognize that's probably not my path. There are lots of very qualified, very hardworking, very talented people who are working in mainstream Hollywood in terms of the films that come out and the franchises and the big box office things. And I think that, you know, maybe in a different life I could have been part of that, but I'm not looking to do that right now.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for me, the the reason I even started to become a filmmaker and the reason I even started to do theater is I just decided I wanted to tell stories that matter, and I wanted to tell them to people who may or may not necessarily know them. And that in doing that, if I'm giving, you know, a voice to people who have none, or if I'm telling a story that somebody says, oh, my God, I had no idea.
That's kind of where I
put my emphasis. It's where I feel my strength lies, because I do know things.
That's definitely what happened to me.
Yeah, I mean, you know things that people don't, and I think it's important that people do.
Absolutely.
How do you tell them? Well,
you pick
a medium that people want to watch.
Yeah, I think. In terms of all of your films, but in particular, the Sacrifice of Finding Hope, I think, should be a family event. It's like, you know, this is what we're going to do. We're going to sit down as a family. We're going to watch this. This is happening to some little girl, some little boy in the world, in this country right now as we're watching this, and dialogue about it, talk about it. What would you do? How would you be an advocate? You know, and I think that those kinds of events, conversations, is what changes the planet. It's what makes, you know, the world, the certain part of the world, a great place to live and be.
I agree completely. And I mean, I guess, again, I feel sort of like the same way I do about children's books, and that there be plenty and that children's imagination be enriched that way. I think that if what you're saying happens, which would be great, is if it's a family discussion and a family event, and then the children are determined to do something in their own lives that makes sure that things change, then that's just all I could hope for.
sure, yeah. You know, it's beautiful to know that you are a seed in the process of evolutionary growth and maturation, you know. It, even though it might look really, really small in one sense, but in another sense, it's huge, because it's something that lives on even after you and I are no longer here. But it's something that needs to be done, and it's a beautiful thing that it happened in this time and this place for us to be able to know about it. Now,
you know, the interesting thing is that. And again, I can't say enough about the actors and the crew and everyone who becomes involved in the projects that I do.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, honestly, they could do something else. They could do something far more lucrative. They could do something easier.
Mm-hmm.
They could do things that were less painful to explore in terms of their own personal involvement with the character. They could have. And they didn't. And when I write something and people like that come together, it's kind of, you recognize that it's actually important to lots of people, not just me.
Absolutely.
You know, and that makes me smile. It makes my heart warm. It's all of those things, because there's a very limited amount of time that everybody in Hollywood has, and yet they always have time for a good project.
A
project with a good heart.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Now, obviously we're talking about, all of these wonderful aspects of you. I want to get in one last piece, and that is, you've got a play called Love Letters.
I do.
Again, this lady here, she just does not believe in sleep, ladies and gentlemen. She believes sleep is bad for you. She probably tells the kids, don't go to sleep, because you'll miss out on being able to do all of these things that I'm doing currently in my life and still manage to somehow be sane. I have no idea how she does this, ladies and gentlemen. I will try and meet with Diane personally and maybe just open her up, brain up or something. I don't know, but I'm going to figure this out, because I want to get some of this. I need to get a little bit of this in my... you think I do a lot. No, I'm looking at this and saying, I don't know how in the hell she does all of this. God. So now, Love Letters is a play that you've done with, that you're directing with Sam Elliott and Catherine Ross. at the Edie Theater in Santa Monica, and this comes out in June, the end of June. Talk to us about that.
So the Broad Theater in Santa Monica has a space, a smaller space called the Edie Space, which is about a 100-person theater as opposed to the 500 one.
Okay.
I say this because tickets are limited. We're trying to make this sort of an intimate relationship as opposed to a large performance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Sam and Catherine have been married for many years, and they've never appeared on the stage together. As part of my working in theater, I'm on the board of the local Malibu Playhouse, which is sort of this little butterfly, you know, it's sort of this caterpillar and a chrysalis becoming a butterfly kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
in which we're hoping to be able to, you know, raise funds enough to be able to make it into sort of this little gem of a theater where people feel it's a destination to go, so that theater is also available on the west side in addition to the Geffen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So as part of that fundraising effort, since Sam and Catherine also live in Malibu, they very kindly offered to do this one night only reading of Love Letters, and I'm very excited about it. One, because they're two such great iconic actors, but
mm-hmm.
also because having never appeared on stage together, this will be an historic moment.
Sure.
And it'll just be fun, because to see the dynamic between the two of them in this context will just be awesome.
Absolutely. Now, are you going to film any of this, or the making of, or is this just going to be a one-off where, you know, it's just going to be a memory to those who attended?
I think it's very possible that it may just be a memory for those who attended. We are selling meet-and-greet tickets so that we have a small reception, a small little wine and catered reception afterwards for those who buy those tickets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be able to sort of meet them, shake their hands, talk to them, say whatever they need to say, which will be in the outside courtyard space at the Edie space in the Broad, on June 29th at 7:30.
Okay, all right.
And I do have to mention one other thing, just because
sure.
I just discovered it. May 8th last year, I was part of a documentary crew that had 50 different directors that
wow.
spent a day in the life of Pasadena Unified. And it turns out that this May 8th in the ArcLight Cinema in Pasadena, all of the 50 films, which are just 4 minutes each, are woven into a full length documentary, will be screening at the ArcLight in Pasadena. And I guess the story that I did is one of the ones that may be more prominently featured for that particular evening. It's about a young female scholar athlete in the Pasadena School District. And basically, it's called Go Public, and it's kind of just an articulation of what public school can be, what public school is lacking, what public school needs, and why public school is important.
Incredible.
So I just wanted to say that that's going to happen May 8th from 6 to 10 at the ArcLight Cinema in Pasadena as well.
Wow, that's beautiful. Now, you know, again, for the lady who doesn't sleep, what other projects, TV projects and film, what are you working on? What's in development? Because I know you have something coming down the pike. Every time you have something coming out, there's always something coming.
well, I have a documentary that we're currently in post-production on. It's a documentary that I did a short film for about a young gentleman who, at the age of 13, left his Burmese village because his people were basically dying from neglect and preventable disease. And he left knowing that he could only come back if he could save them, because they were just sort of targeted for this ethnic cleansing that the formerly rigid Myanmar regime had exposed them to. You know, no infrastructure, no healthcare, no education, stuff like that. So at the age of 13, he ventured forth, walked from the jungle 7 days, walked to the capital, learned Burmese dialect proper because he only knew his tribal dialect, went to high school, graduated, walked to India. This is the brief version. Went to college, taught himself Hindi and English, graduated with honors, managed to get the funds to pay for one semester and one flight to Armenia, which was a place where medical school was available at the least expensive tuition. And 15 years later, I met him on the eve of his medical school graduation, and he was determined not to open up a practice in the West and forget that he'd ever been in the jungle, but to return to that part of the world and make a difference in terms of training the people of his different villages in healthcare, in sanitation, in diagnosis, and in preventive care so
wow.
that his people would stop dying. And
this is someone you personally met.
Oh, yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. I became friends with him because I happened to be traveling with another international humanitarian named Lady Caroline Cox, who is a global force majeure. She's a humanitarian of epic proportions, and she's a member of the House of Lords. And she and I became friends, and I traveled with her, and then I met Sasa, as I said, on the eve of his medical school graduation, decided that this was a story that needed to be told again, because nobody knew about it, and if I didn't tell it, who would? And so the 7-minute short that we made did very well and was awarded a bunch of different things, and then he actually came to the United States for the first time last summer, and one of the festivals that showed the short was the Holly Shorts Film Festival at Grauman's Chinese Theater, and this was the first time he'd been to a movie theater.
Wow.
And he saw his own film on the theater screen. It was kind of a surreal experience for us all.
Yeah. Wow.
And he was here in an effort to sort of, you know, build relationships with the United States organizations and government agencies in order to, he's basically now back where he began, trying to create an infrastructure with the help of international organizations, with his own people, and actually trying to work with the government of Burma as well. So he's a remarkable young man. He's a remarkable
yes.
man. And so we have been filming all of these years, and now we are ready to put together the full-length documentary, which Lindsay Mofford is working on in post as far as putting together the final cut.
And we will roughly see this around what time?
We're hoping that we'll be done sometime around summer, and then we'll see what we do with it as a full length, whether we try to distribute it on TV or whether we try to give it a theatrical or festival screenings. I'm not sure yet. It'll just really depend on what our options are at the time once we're finished.
Well, you definitely have us involved. We definitely will do whatever we can with the Philippe Matthews Show to get that out. That is an unbelievably incredible story. Oh, my God.
He's a very rare and awe-inspiring person, and yet so humble and so caring. He's a great man.
You know what? They call me the Oprah of Internet, but doggone it, you are going to be on Oprah. I am predicting this right now. You and perhaps it might, if it's not the current film that's out, this film that's coming out, oh, this is Oprah's stuff, baby. You are all in Oprah's camp, okay? You are what she reads. You are what she watches. You are Oprah's stuff. And I'm just saying, just throwing it out there that I believe, and I know for a fact she doesn't believe in sleep either. So I know for a fact that you guys would probably just have a whole conversation about insomnia just in general, and then you'll be able to share this. That's what the world needs, because this needs to get out, not just on the Internet, but this needs to get out in the world, and nobody does it better than Oprah. But I predict this is going to be a huge, huge piece.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be speaking with you, and I would be equally honored to be speaking with Oprah because I think she's awesome. She's like one of the, you know, she's like one of the main mover and shakers of this entire era, I would say.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you on that. Absolutely. Absolutely. My goodness. So what's next for you and your career goals? I know it's a really crazy, nutty question because obviously you're living it. But you probably, in that crazy sleep-deprived brain of yours, have other goals and dreams and aspirations. What would they be in your career?
Well, you know, I do. I mean, because Mrs. Scrooge the musical was such a success for West of Broadway,
mm-hmm.
And because I, you know, if forced to choose, because I love theater like Scarecrow, I love theater most of all. I'm hoping that Mrs. Scrooge the musical will move forward in a more regional way in the coming years. We have a pretty wonderful composer and arranger who's been doing the songs with me. And as soon as we've completed what I believe to be the entirety of the song repertoire, I think that we'll be out there trying to get a regional backing for Mrs. Scrooge, which,
mm-hmm. Nice.
You know, we got such wonderful reviews last time we put it up that I felt like we needed to wait until everything was completely ready to start, you know, to start moving it forward. So that's my
mm-hmm.
one hope for that. And that brings a tremendous amount of joy to families who see it, and that's the most fun of all, sitting in an audience, watching an audience enjoy something that you've put together and, you know, sort of gasp in horror when they're scared and
mm-hmm,
cry
mm-hmm.
when they're touched and, you know, laugh and clap when they're happy is just one of the best feelings ever.
It totally is.
So I'm hoping that Mrs. Scrooge will make a splash in the next year or so. And then, as I said, I was hoping that Finding Hope would, in its different incarnation, end up as a television series. So we're still working on that.
Nice.
And then I just have also returned to a number of the screenplays that I've written over the years.
Mm-hmm.
There's been an increased interest in looking at my work because these were things that, like, won awards and then got options and then, you know, this is kind of what led me to make my own film to begin with, is that, you know, there's so much that depends on the serendipity of others that when you're just the writer, that I
mm-hmm.
decided to take matters into my own small budget hands when I decided to become a filmmaker. But because of the renewed interest in my scripts, I'm going to see whether there are a couple of those. I'm going to send them back out in the world again and see what happens. Because
dust them off the shelf and put them all back out there, darling. I mean, anything that comes from your mind needs to be in the world, okay? Just know that, and don't worry about it. Just whatever, you might have probably 100 screenplays, just put them out there because it's all going to be awesome.
Well,
if it's in the mind of Diane Nam, it's going to be awesome, okay? Ladies and gentlemen, this is a lady that's got still 10 new children's books coming out between now and 2013. I mean, you're just amazing. You're just amazing. I just love you to death. And not even to death, I love you to pieces. That's better. And would love to have you come back on the show anytime just to talk about anything that you're doing.
Well, because
whatever you're doing is going to be great for the world, and the world needs greatness right now. And doggone it, you're great. So
well,
thank you.
Thank you.
For showing
I feel
up
the
in
same
this
way
time.
About you. Just let's be clear.
Unbelievably amazing. I won't sleep tonight. I'm gonna tell my sweetheart. It's like I just talked to the most amazing person. Oh my
God.
Thank
you for saying that, but I really, the secret is you do have to sleep. Because you know what? When you sleep, a lot of stuff gets resolved.
That is so true. I know that's true. Because all of this stuff comes up from, like, sleeping. You wake up like, oh, my God, I got to write this down.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's so true. That is so true. Amazing.
I believe in productive sleep.
Oh, my gosh. All right, Diane, are there any web addresses or anything that we needed or that we forgot about? I know West of Broadway.
The film website is ladyofthecanyon.com.
LadyOfTheCanyon.com.
And the westofbroadway.org.
Westofbroadway.org, got it.
And that's the theater. And those two sites are pretty, and I have Facebook pages, which I would love people to, you know, hit me up for, either the Diane Nam public figure page or the Diane Nam personal page or the Finding Hope page, the West of Broadway page. Everything's got a page.
So everything has to have a page.
And you can find me on Twitter and every LinkedIn, all the social network things.
Fantastic. All right, my love. I can't wait for you to come back. Just make the commitment that you will, and then I can actually sleep tonight.
I would love both things to happen.
All right, my love. You have a wonderful, wonderful day, and keep doing what you're doing, and blessings to you, and can't wait to get you back on.
Well, thank you, and the same to you.
All right, my dear. You take care.
Okay, bye.